Welcome to Query, where we provide simple answers to complex tech questions. My name is Serenity Caldwell, and I am joined, as always, well, technically for the first time, by my co-host, Stephen Hackett. Hi, Stephen.
Hey, welcome to the show.
Welcome to the show.
It's a new show. The paint's still drying. Nah, the furniture's here yet. But
yeah, we're kind of, it's a little bit echoey, but we're gonna make it a home. We're gonna make it special.
There you go. I have my beta fish here on the desk, so you know it's not quite barren. So this is Query. We are going to answer tech questions together. So you and I both have a deep background in this, and you write for iMore and write tons of great stuff there. You've got a background in Apple retail, as do I. So I think this will be a lot of fun to kind of get back into.
Yeah, we balanced it out. Stephen, of course, is a former genius for Apple, and I was a former creative. And both of us, I feel like, answer questions on a daily basis on Twitter. So rather than just limit our answers to 140 characters, we're like, well, maybe we could do a podcast together and answer all your stuff. So that's what we're going to do.
Yeah. So this is episode zero. It's a sort of our members episode, work out some kinks. But I think we should just get right in to this. And we're going to start because it's the summer. And summer in Apple land means betas, right? So how should I prepare to run an iOS or macOS beta? Should I run an iOS or Mac beta? How do I install them? All these questions around betas because this is the season of new software from Apple.
Yeah. So I think the very first thing that we should probably tackle is, should you run the beta at all? Now, this is a little bit different than the way things have been in the past because Apple for the last couple of years has offered public betas alongside the developer betas. Previously, if you ever wanted to run beta software on a Mac, you were stuck kind of paying the money for a developer account and ponying up and getting the pre-release software, which publicly I always advocated against unless you really wanted to, you know, put your device's life into your own hands. What about you, Stephen? Were you on the like, don't do it, or they're like, yeah, bring on all of the bugs and the random crashes?
Yeah, I mean, before the public beta time, I was a developer member because I worked in Apple support. Even when I left the Apple store, I did that. I did IT for a long time. And so I would usually have the beta, you know, on an external drive, you know, for my MacBook Pro or something. Eventually, when I started writing Mac OS X reviews, I would put them on a secondary system. So I sacrificed the home Mac Mini a couple years, you know, made it completely unusable for months at a time for anyone else but me. And now I do run them, but I do so cautiously because, you know, I have a production machine that no beta ever goes onto, but I have a laptop that is a little more expendable. Like if it's sort of out of commission for a while, it's not the end of the world. So
doesn't ruin your life.
Yeah. I think the first beta I ran was probably Snow Leopard. I feel like I ran the 10.6 beta. I think I thought that one was going to be pretty safe because they said, quote, no new features. It turns out it was, if memory serves correctly, it was actually a pretty decent beta. And I think, one of the all-time great releases out of the OS X era. So I think Snow Leopard was my first.
Yeah, that's a good intro one. The first beta that I remember playing with was actually a beta of, well, if you don't count the public beta 10.0, which my dad installed on my
wow.
iMac when I was but a wee girl.
That was a world of hurt, I'm sure.
Oh yeah. I just remember this wonderful, wonderful world where I would, I've quickly learned how to dual boot your Mac. So it's like a switch from the public beta land back to classic and be like, oh, if I actually want Photoshop to work, I have to go back.
Right. Yeah. And to be clear, this isn't like a public beta of a new version of OS X. It was a public beta of OS X, like the very first one.
OS X 10.0 in the early aughts.
It came on a CD, like, in the mail. Very different time.
Exactly.
Very different time.
No online software updates. I mean, after that, I think I got into the program around Tiger because I was really excited about the dock. And I remember being really excited about Dashboard. I was like, widgets! Widgets are going to be the future! Because apparently that's what you get excited about when you're in high school. Yeah. So speaking, I feel like that actually segues into a really nice way of talking about, like, how do you deal with betas in the modern age now that we no longer have to, you know, install them on CDs, et cetera. And Steven, you mentioned about having production machines and, you know, machines that don't touch the betas. And I think that's the biggest thing that I would recommend is if you are considering going down the beta rabbit hole, there are kind of two paths you can take, right? You can dive into the developer beta, which is usually the buggier and less stable of the two, because Apple is trying to put out as many as they can so that developers can basically break it and also test their own software. Or you can go down the public beta rabbit hole, which is still buggy, but a little bit more, camera ready, so to speak. So with both of those, I kind of recommend either if you have multiple devices to install iOS or macOS on, that's a really nice way of doing it. But if you are not, like you like me or Steven, you don't have like iPhones lying around, the best thing that you can do on your Mac is partition your hard drive, which is what I did for OS X public beta way back in 2001. Which is to basically make a little section of your hard drive that that is just designed to run the beta. And that way you can have it kind of in a little siloed atmosphere. You can still access your files, but you're not messing up your regular operating system. And if it goes completely FUBAR, you can just destroy that partition and not ruin your Mac. I feel like that's a good safe way to do it if you're not like, I've got five Macs lying around, I guess I'm gonna install a beta on one of them.
Yeah, having that separation is really nice. And to back up just a second, there is a relationship between the developer builds and the public betas. Historically, you know, we're not quite sure what they're gonna do this year. It's very early in the process for these releases. But generally, the public beta is every other developer build. So sometimes the dev builds will be like, one's pretty good, it's the public beta, and the next one's like super broken again, and they fix that stuff, and that becomes a public beta. So there's a TikTok effect. I think for most people, the public beta is the way to go. And Apple actually makes it pretty easy to do all of this. You know, you talked about partitioning a drive on a Mac, but you can even do in like an external drive. I have mine on an external SSD, and macOS makes it very easy to install on another disk or another partition. iOS, it's a little bit harder, right? You can't really do that on an iOS device, but at least on the Mac, it can be pretty straightforward to do this and leave your data intact somewhere, leave it safe and sound. For me, if macOS High Sierra explodes that SSD, then like I can just unplug it and boot my MacBook Pro from its internal drive and I'm fine.
Yeah. And you're not going to worry about things. Yeah. So that's a good question about iOS devices, right? Because I am lucky / cursed enough to have a couple iOS devices lying around between an iPad and an iPhone. But what about people who don't have a secondary iOS device who want to test the beta but also don't want to brick their phone? Like, at what point, Steven, would you recommend them jumping onto the beta process?
You know, I think if you want to do it, I think, you know, my sort of rule of thumb is give the public beta, you know, two or three releases. So that may put you well into July potentially, but having the public beta be around for a little while, I think it starts to stabilize. But, you know, there's more to think about than just the OS, right? Like some apps may not work. Like I know right now, like workflow extensions don't work, which if you're a workflow user is a big problem. So it is more, there's more to consider than just the OS. You need to kind of understand that apps may not work, services may not work, and sort of that all kind of goes into it together. So, you know, I like two or three public betas in that gives everybody some time to be working on their stuff and it's not quite at the bleeding edge.
Yeah, I tend to agree with you. Absolutely. And the other thing to think about when installing on an iOS device, you mentioned that apps may not work right. Remember that app developers probably know this and they're working hard because they've had access to the developer beta. So they've super broken their devices trying to fix things. Please be gentle to your favorite apps. If you install a beta, understand that it is not the developer's fault if the app is broken right now. And in fact, the developer has no public, no requirement to you to make that app work before the thing actually ships.
But I will say, if you ask nicely to developers of your favorite apps, you are probably more likely going to get a nice answer and or an invite maybe to their test flight, which would get you maybe a working version of their software because it's also beta, rather than if you complain on Twitter and be like, WTF, why doesn't Procreate work anymore? Table flip, you know?
Yeah, that's not cool. And sometimes, I mean, the test flight may be the only way out of that because depending on what the fix is, the developer may not be able to ship that until iOS 11 comes out. You know, if the fix requires some iOS 11 specific things, there in the past, developers have been caught not being able to submit those to the App Store or having to like sneak them in another update. So as frustrated as the users may be, my friends who are developers are very often frustrated as well that they know the fix, but they can't quite get it in yet. And so they have to rely on things like test flight. But I think the most important thing is to make sure that if something does go wrong, you can have your data and you can get back to where you were. You know, on the Mac, that's pretty straightforward. We talked about partitioning and external drives, but on iOS, it's a little bit harder, right? Like you can't partition an iPad. You can't necessarily roll back super easily, but I think there are some things you can do to make sure that your data is safe and sound if the worst happens.
Yeah. And that's a great point. So if you're deciding, if you're like, yeah, I'm going to jump in on this beta life, whether it's a developer beta or a public beta, the steps that you want to take before actually going to Apple's website and clicking download include backing up your stuff, because backups are very important. I have seen multiple people on Twitter already being like, iOS 11, I'm so excited to run this on my brand new 10.5-inch iPad Pro. Oh, darn, I just bricked my 10.5-inch iPad Pro. So to avoid things like that, or rather make them less painful, you want to make sure that you have encrypted backups of your iOS devices. Encrypted iTunes backups are probably the best way to go. Like, as much as I hate being like, connect your phone or tablet to your computer and make a backup, or use Wi-Fi sync and make a backup, because iCloud is much, much easier. iTunes backups are nice because you can roll back to previous versions of the iOS, whereas iCloud, is that right, Steven, that iCloud can only applies to the new OS if you're trying to restore?
I believe so. So if you have an iCloud backup on iOS 10 and then you upgrade to the 11 beta and your iCloud backup runs again, you can't use that backup if you go back to 10. So that's why having that encrypted iTunes backup on the side is super helpful. If you need to go back to iOS 10 and you don't want to start over, you can at least revert to that backup as opposed to the newer one in iCloud. So it's a little bit tricky, but if you plan ahead, you can make sure that you're safe.
Yeah, for sure. And like Steven said, backing up on a Mac is relatively simple. Obviously, you can always use Time Machine. But we really recommend if you're going to install a beta on a Mac to either use an external drive or a partition. There's really no reason to just do a flat over install on your Mac unless you're just like, you know, goodbye, Sierra. I never want to see you again. It's all high Sierra from here on out. Yeah.
I mean, YOLO, I guess. I don't know.
Yeah. Yeah, you're taking your life into your own hands. This podcast is not responsible for YOLOs.
That's right. We are no way responsible for anything that goes wrong. Anything in any part of your life, not just iOS betas. So, I mean, there's
the wrong thing at the grocery store.
It's not my fault you dropped your gallon of milk walking out of Kroger. Not my fault. There's always this tension, right? Every summer. Like, I feel it now. I am not running any iOS betas yet, but I keep thinking about it, and I have this new 10.5-inch iPad. Like, it'd be really cool to have it on there, but I'm trying to follow my own advice and give the public beta some time to sort of settle in before I do it. But there's always that pull, right? Like yesterday, I was like, you know, what if I just go ahead and do it? You know, it's that little voice in your head. Multitasking is great. Trying to tune
swipes,
that voice out for
Steven,
now.
Steven, the new control center.
That's a topic for another time. I don't like the new control center.
Oh, hush.
It's my personal taste. It looks like a crazy person puzzle.
We'll talk about that. Yeah, as you said, later. But I am ashamed to say that I have not followed my own advice because
oh, no.
I have the developer beta on both one of my production phones and my production iPad, which is to say, I'm an idiot, and I'm okay with being an idiot. I'm okay with being the village idiot here and take in the fall. But primarily, I did it because I have the luxury of having other iOS devices in this house. So it's like, if I completely mess up my 7 Plus, I still have an iPhone 7 sitting in a drawer that I can pull out and, you know, use if like the worst comes to happen. Or, you know, if I brick my 10.5 inch iPad Pro, I still have an older 12.9 inch iPad Pro that I can use to test. And that's like the weird life of being a tech writer is that you just have a bunch of gadgets in your house. So it's less of a it's less of a commitment. I don't know if I would do it if I just had like two iOS devices. I don't know if I'd be like, YOLO. But then again, I did run the OS 10 public beta, so I don't know.
Yeah, it's like, you know, some people like pull out a drawer and it's all like matched undershirts, right? They're all the same. You just pull out a drawer, it's all iPhones. It's like ready to go.
Yeah. Oh, it's all that. speaking of devices that you really should be careful of before installing, we mentioned the Mac and iOS. There's one category of device that I strongly, strongly, strongly urge not installing a beta on until it's closer to production, and that's the Apple Watch. Because the Apple Watch, you cannot roll back. There is no way to roll back an Apple Watch unless you send it directly to Apple. So if you FUBAR your Apple Watch, you're basically sending it on a one-way trip to Apple Depot to make it better.
Yeah, it's. I have many questions about the process. I'm sure we take this board out and put a new board in, but the watch is so much a satellite of the phone, right? It doesn't. If you ever run a software update on your watch, you know it takes forever. Even on a Series 2, it takes a long time, and it's so tethered to the phone. Yeah, it's definitely a one-way street. I totally agree. Like, unless you were building a Watch OS app, then I would steer far away from that. And I mean, WatchOS 3, did I get the numbers right? WatchOS 3 works with iOS 11. So it's not like if you put the public beta on your iPhone, then your watch suddenly doesn't work with it. It's backwards compatible. So you don't feel like you have to do something really risky with the watch. Cause if it goes south, there is, like you said, there's really no way out without a repair.
And WatchOS 3, yeah, as you said, I've been running iOS 11 with a WatchOS 3 device, and I've had no issues whatsoever. So, and it's amusingly so, I've actually had fewer issues with iOS 11 and WatchOS 3 than iOS 10 and WatchOS 3. So, yeah, steer clear of WatchOS 4 until we're down the line. And that's also the reason why there's no public beta for WatchOS 4 or hasn't been historically, is because it's so difficult to roll back. The last thing Apple wants to do is be like, here, have this free beta that destroys your device for 6 weeks.
Yeah, genius bars are just flooded with angry nerds. Dear listener, we want to hear from you. We want to answer your questions. So you can use the hashtag AskQuery on Twitter and we will see it. You should also follow the show. It's at Query Show on Twitter, but you don't have to follow. You don't have to even mention any of us. We're using internet magic to search that hashtag. So that is Ask Query, and we will answer your questions on the show. A big topic for High Sierra is VR development and potentially VR gaming and eGPUs. I think there's a lot of questions around that. People who may be interested in VR gaming, but you know they don't want to build a PC or they don't have a PlayStation Pro or whatever you need. They just want to do it on the Mac. Is that what Apple's talking about in High Sierra? Like, what's going on with eGPUs?
Yeah. So with High Sierra, Apple is officially supporting an external graphics unit for the first time. External graphics units, which basically consist of a big fat housing that looks like a small tower in its own right, and a graphics card that can be connected to a computer in some way. And folks who are in graphic design and, you know, 3D rendering are no stranger to these, especially if they work in a PC environment. They're very useful to basically supercharge your computer so that it can handle more intense rendering tasks, whether you're working on a project as a designer or whether you're a gamer and you're just like, I've built this, you know, this basic computer, and now I want a graphics card that's powerful enough either to, say, run my VR headset or run, you know, a really frame rate intensive game on my computer. On the Mac, Apple has not necessarily come right out and said, no, this is not okay, but they made it very difficult for people to run external GPUs in the past. And that's largely because the latency just wasn't great between the external kit and the Mac, where it's just, you know, Apple, it's like they don't want to officially support anything that's going to be a subpar experience. So there are homebrew people hiding around in the shadows, including eGPU.io, who do great work in terms of, like, here are the cards that are compatible with Macs, and here's how you can do this, and here are the terminal commands that you need to know. But the good news is, as of High Sierra, that deep, dark well of occasional terror has become just a little bit, you know, brought into the light a little bit, because Apple is basically saying, we're now going to support these boxes. And by now, there's an asterisk on that. Now means 2018. We're going to support these boxes.
Soon.
Yeah, very soon. But in the meantime, Apple is shipping a developer kit, primarily, again, for VR-based developers and high-end graphics folks to get a chance to, again, break things, but also make sure that this is, in fact, like, this is going to work with their workflow. And the big change, like, the reason why Apple was like, you know, nah brah on GPUs and now is like, yeah, let's do this, is Thunderbolt 3 being widely available. Like, Thunderbolt 3 makes this possible without the latency or the nonsense to make somebody frustrated. It actually, it works.
So this will be available to MacBook Pro users, you know, the new style with the touch bar, or the 13 without, and then the new iMacs, and then, you know, hopefully things moving forward, you know, the iMac Pro, the Mac Pro. So no Mac Mini support, because rest in peace Mac Mini, I guess. And then the little MacBook is just USB, even though the port looks the same, which is super confusing and a topic for another time.
Oh, yeah.
But but I kind of like the idea of having, even though I sit in front of a large iMac every day, I like the idea of, like, I could have a MacBook Pro and take my work with me, but then when I sit down at my desk to edit 4K video or to work on my VR game or to potentially play VR in Steam or something, then I plug this big box in and my MacBook Pro becomes a lot more powerful.
Yeah, I think it's a really smart. I mean, it's essentially the equivalent of an external display, except now instead of an external display, it's an external graphics card. And it really opens up the avenue for people who want to have a portable computer in their day-to-day lives, but also need the power of a desktop machine. So it gives them kind of the best of both worlds, which is really, really awesome. Steven, have you gotten a chance to see the eGPU in action, the kit that they're shipping?
I have not. I have one friend locally who's a PC gamer, and he has used one on his tower that he built. So I've kind of seen one. I've seen videos about it. But, you know, this kit from Apple, you have to be a registered developer. I think it's like $500 or $600 to get one right now. And it's only like, it's one chassis and it's one video card. So I have a lot of questions about, you know, is Apple going to allow me to buy any video card and put it in there? My guess is there'll be very limited options, but I am excited about it. You know, someone who does professional grade work, you know, having that extra horsepower without having to buy a whole new computer, you know, every 2 years could be really interesting. I think Apple still needs to finish the story about what it means for consumers. Like, I've gotten some emails and questions about, like, hey, if I buy an iMac and buy this, can I play VR? Like, probably. Like, I mean, it seems like that's where they're going, but some of those details Apple needs to fill in a little bit. And I think they will as we get to High Sierra being released this fall, and then as these things come out next year sometime, I think Apple will finish telling that story.
So what is interesting is that all of these components, you know, it's not like Apple is like got Sonnet, who makes the external GPUs housing, is like, hey, Sonnet, make this housing specially for us for this kit. This kit or this housing has been available for the public to buy for a little bit. Same thing with the Radeon card that ships in here. What Apple is essentially like the thing that Apple is providing is saying that this specific thing, we have tested it and it works 100% flawlessly with our current High Sierra beta. So there are, as you said, there are different like combinations of GPUs and chassis that can work with a MacBook Pro currently. However, the end result, what you're going to get right now in summer 2017 is probably going to be vastly different than what you're going to get when High Sierra actually comes out. Our VR guy over at VR Heads, Russell Hawley, had a chance to get the developer kit last week. And he's, you know, he's a big time VR head, and has all of the VR headsets basically in his room. It's like it's a shrine practically. And he was really excited because Apple is making it incredibly easy to connect it. It's basically plug and play and reboot the Mac and it's ready, which is great. It's as anybody who's done the crazy terminal workflows before, it's a very, a much simplified way of working with this stuff. But right now, beyond plugging it into the Mac and getting immediate benefits from, say, you know, working on software that requires heavy rendering or playing existing Mac games, there's nothing you can really do in VR right now, because while Steam VR, the support for the Steam VR store is there, there are no Steam VR titles for the Mac right now. So there's, you know, you can go into the store and you can put on the HTC Vive and you can walk around like the gray setup room. But you can't actually do much because, again, we go back to our first topic, developer betas. Like this is, it's not designed for public consumption right now, which means that the focus is on making this work well for the people who want to develop inside VR, or develop for VR experiences rather than the consumers who want to play VR.
Yeah. So I think, you know, the questions about what this means, I think the answer is a little unknown. There's got to be support on lots of different people's parts. You know, the developers have to support it. Games have to support it. Consumers have to want it for all that demand to be there. Like, but it's exciting that Apple's doing it. You know, it's been out in the world for a while, and, you know, the Mac historically isn't a great gaming platform always, but it seems like maybe this is a push, or at the very least, they want the Mac to be at the center of development of game content. And I think that's great. So I'm excited to see where it goes.
Yeah. And the one thing I do want to mention about this is that, again, our guy, Russell Hawley, over at iMore, he's very excited about the future of what this necessarily means for the Mac and VR, because as you mentioned, Stephen, like, I don't think Apple is at, you know, next year going to be like, buy this box. You know, I really think if Apple's going to market a good VR experience for your average user, I think it will probably be a lot slicker and not just like plug in these component parts. But here is a, you know, maybe even a Mac Mini style thing where it's just like, here's this lovely thing and you can plug it into an iMac, or you can plug it into, you know, your laptop and then it works magically with the TV with AirPlay 2. Who knows? I'm like going down rabbit holes here, but I'm excited about it. And it is also worth noting that if you want to experiment with VR, you are not required to get this this GPU set as a developer. That current highest end iMac supports the state, like has a good enough graphics card that you wouldn't need an external kit. And the upcoming iMac Pro in December will also theoretically support, will be VR ready. So if you're interested, if you're like down the line and thinking like, maybe even I don't want to play around with VR, but I want to know like what kind of Macs I should be keeping an eye out for. That's what kind of Macs you should be keeping an eye out for. So we're almost done with the show, but we're going to close out with something that right now we're tentatively calling the lightning round. Hopefully we'll come up with a better name for it by episode one. And that's where we're just going to really quickly bang through some questions that we don't necessarily need to devote a whole section of the podcast to, but we still thought they were worth answering. So, Stephen, what is up with Scott Forstall suddenly appearing from nowhere to talk about the iPhone?
Yeah, so he did this interview at the Computer History Museum. He's wearing the same shirt he used to wear. There's kind of a joke going on Twitter about that. I'm really curious as to this. You know, he has been silent. He's been out of the public spotlight. He's been producing Broadway shows. Like, he's not working in tech at all. And then he comes out and does this interview. You know, is it that the NDA expired? Is it Apple or Forstall playing defense against there's a new book about the making of the iPhone that's been hotly contested? I don't know. I'm glad he's doing it. The interview is really fascinating. I'm about halfway through it now, but it's very strange to see him back talking about this when he's been gone from the public eye for so long.
Yeah. I just want to hear more about his Broadway show excursion. Like, how is Broadway like tech?
Yeah. I mean, maybe he just needed a complete break. I don't know. So what's up with that Logitech Slim Combo keyboard case for the new 10.5-inch iPad Pro?
Oh, Steven, it hurts my heart so much.
Next.
Yeah, I know. Like, right. It's like, no, we can't talk about the Logitech, which made the Create keyboard case, which I love for the 9.7-inch iPad, decided to go back to the drawing board for the 10.5 and made something that is like almost a Surface Pro. But not quite, like, it turns your iPad into a Surface Pro, and that there's a kickstand and a detachable keyboard case that's a smart connecting keyboard case, and that it has like a little loop on the top for your pencil. In principle, I think they did this because they wanted to make a smart connector case that you were able to like bend, like get a better viewing angles rather than just kind of the straight up and down that most of the other smart connector cases. In practice, it's so clunky. It's so clunky. It's thick. It's not nearly as well made as the Create, and it leaves me wanting a new version of the Create. So I'm sorry, Logitech. I really wanted to like this keyboard, and I'm sure plenty of people did, but I would not recommend it if you need a keyboard for your 10.5-inch iPad Pro.
Yeah, I saw a picture of it floating around on Twitter that it's like as thick as the old unibody MacBook Pro. It's like not,
it is.
Not great. Not great.
So let's close out this round. Steven, in iOS 11, I know that you can search your handwriting on the iPad Pro. Like you can write something and then it'll be searchable in Spotlight and in Notes. But you can also scan documents in the Notes app. Can you get OCR'd search content in those documents, or is that just limited to handwriting right now?
At this point, it's just limited to handwriting, which I find really like an odd thing. You're already doing this work on the handwriting. Like running OCR on the text seems like the logical next step. But if you do need that, there are a lot of great iOS apps that do it. I really like PDF Pen from our friends at Smile, but there's lots of apps that do it on the iPhone and the iPad, but currently Notes, the scanning thing, does not. And I kind of wonder if that'll be something that makes it in this year or something that maybe they add, you know, down the road, because it seems like a really logical feature to have in Notes at this point.
Absolutely. Maybe it's, you know, first step, make AR Kit work in Notes. Second step, make the PDF actually scannable. Or maybe not. Who knows?
Yeah, who knows? I will say, though, like Notes, man, the Notes team is really on it the last couple of years. It's really gotten to be really good.
Yeah.
So I think that brings us to the end of the episode.
Oh, my gosh. Episode zero in the can.
It's done. Thank you for listening to Query. To submit questions, you can tweet the hashtag AskQuery, and we will see it. In the meantime, you can find us both on Twitter. And this is when I ask you, how do you pronounce your Twitter handle? I don't think I've ever heard it said out loud.
It's Saturn. Saturn. S-E-T-T-E-R-N. Yeah. Like Saturn, okay. Or Saturn. Saturn. Yeah. No, Saturn. It was a nonsense word that I picked. And it turns out that it's actually the Swedish word for an Irish setter, which is weird. But I'll take it.
There you go. There you go. And of course, you can find all of Serenity's writing over at imore.com. You can find me on Twitter at ismh, and I write 512pixels.net. So until our first real episode, Serenity, say goodbye.
Goodbye.
Adios.